Already 3 weeks into 1995, January the 21st, 1995. My name is Don Ecker, the show UFOs Tonight, and each week, coast to coast, we bring you news on one of humankind's most misunderstood subjects, and that, of course, is the subject of UFOs. And joining me tonight in studio once again, Mr. Dwight Schultz, to help me carry this program through. Dwight, good to see you.
Good to see you, Don. I've been looking for CRN. I can't find it. I know it announces it itself. It presents this show every week, but I have yet to see CRN. So I'm not
the
quite
sign,
sure.
The sign is right over there on the window.
Well, but I mean, this show is supposed to deal with truth, and I don't know that CRN presents this show. But I do. Can I say something, Don? I want to say happy birthday to Frank Lupo tonight. It's his 40th birthday. He was a writer, producer, and co-creator of the A-Team and a very good friend of mine for a very long time. And there's another new listener in the Bay Area.
40.
Big
one. Can you trust anybody over 30?
I can trust anybody right about now as old as I am.
Oh.
So, and we have another new listener tonight in the Bay Area, a very, very dear friend of mine, John Comerford, a man who was my agent in New York City and... is responsible for me making some very, very good decisions at a time when I didn't trust what I was hearing, and he told me and steered me in the right way, and I'm well off, I guess, today because of John, and he's a bright
man. This is all touching, but what the hell does that have to do with UFOs?
Well, you told me I could say anything I wanted to say. It didn't matter. I mean, isn't that what we do every week?
Go ahead, make me look bad.
All right. And we have a great show tonight. And I want you to go ahead and tell everybody. This is a very special show for me because this is someone that I have watched and read his books, and I've listened to him and watched him debate. And he claims to be a voice of sanity and reason, and I think he is to a large degree, but not all the time. And I've really been looking forward to this show tonight.
Well, you know, this show presents all questions of the UFO question of the UFO enigma. We present all sides, just like UFO Magazine does. We take a look at the pro as well as the con side. And tonight's guest is a special guest. It's a gentleman that was on this program before, roughly a little over a year and a half ago, give or take a couple of months.
Yes.
And it's somebody that I've been trying to get back. And last summer, for a number of months, I tried to get this gentleman on the program because at that time, the question about the Roswell incident was heating up.
Information.
Well, this is a place where there used to be an atomic bomb wing about almost 50 years ago down there, a bomb wing called the 509th. And in July of 1947, if we are to believe people like William Moore, Stanton Friedman, Kevin Randall, Don Schmidt,
some of those people,
a very strange incident happened. People claim that a so-called flying saucer crashed there, and subsequently the government covered it up. Well, tonight's guest has been described as the Sherlock Holmes of ufology. I think Walt Andrus, the international director of MUFON, referred to him as the younger brother of Sherlock Holmes, but we're not sure about that. But tonight's guest is none other than Mr. Phil Klass. Phil has been a voice, although on the pro side of the UFO question, not always a welcome voice, but has been a voice in the field of UFO research for over 30 years. And I'd like to take this opportunity to welcome Phil once again to UFOs Tonight. Phil, thank you for joining us back in Washington.
Well, Don, thank you very much. I expect that those will be the kindest words that I will hear during the next 2 hours.
Well, this is Dwight Schultz, Mr. Klassen. It's a great pleasure and an honor
to share
our radio program with you.
Phil, let's get right down to brass tacks. This week, I received your latest issue of the Skeptics UFO newsletter. And I would like to take this opportunity to advise everybody that has an interest in this field that I think it's very important that publications like this should be read. And before we get the program over tonight, Phil, I want you to tell everybody how they can subscribe to the Skeptics UFO newsletter. But once again, you have taken a very investigative tack toward the question of some of what you called key eyewitness testimony. The very first person mentioned in the new issue of the Skeptics UFO newsletter is Jim Ragsdale, who is a witness that Kevin Randall and Don Schmidt used in their latest book, The Truth About the UFO Crash at Roswell. And even Mr. Randall now is stating that Mr. Ragsdale has changed his story from what it originally was.
Significantly.
What can you tell us about this? And for those people out there, Phil, that may not be aware of this individual in the field, can you lay a little background for that?
Well, I've never met him. When I was down to Roswell last March for the press conference in behalf of Randall and Schmidt's new book, I tried to meet with him. I talked to him on the phone, invited him to dinner. He claimed that he had an illness that would prevent it. So I've never met the gentleman.
No, I think, to be fair, Phil, we have to say that Mr. Ragsdale is, in fact, very ill.
Well, he told me he had, as I recall it, a cancer of the throat or something of that sort, a rather serious. But in any event, as you and I know, one of the ways in which one spots a tall tale is if the person significantly changes their story. What do I mean by significant? Well, if you, for example, were to say that you had a UFO sighting shortly after lunch about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and then sometime later in describing it you said that it happened about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I do not consider that a significant discrepancy. Particularly if it happened a few years ago. But if, for example, you said you were alone, walking alone at night when you saw the UFO, and then later, in a later account, you said you were walking with your brother and sister and wife, that there were four of you present, that would be what I would consider a significant discrepancy.
Well, the fact that Ragsdale, in fact, did change his story, and there is some speculation about this, that it may have been for a monetary purpose.
That was what Kevin Randall said
in
his talk.
And if Ragsdale had been the only witness to this event, that certainly would cast doubt on it. But let's go back to the very beginning, and we can hit on Ragsdale again.
Yeah.
In July of 1947, the only nuclear-powered, nuclear-armed military unit in the planet was the 509th Bomb Wing, the same folks that dropped the atomic bomb on the Japanese, which ended World War II. They were based at Walker Field outside of Roswell, New Mexico.
It was called Roswell Army Air Field at the time, but later renamed Walker Air Field.
And the group itself was considered one of the most elite and secret groups then in existence because of the fact that they were the only people that had nuclear weapons. Along sometime between July 2nd to July 4th, an event happened that today still is much argued over, which is one of the reasons this program is on the air tonight. Originally, the regular Army Air Force, it was before the, it became the United States Air Force. It was still then a part of the Army.
Right. It was a couple of months. Actually, the transition, I think, occurred in mid or late September when it changed from being the Army Air Force to the U.S. Air Force, an independent service.
Right. An independent service. But it was the regular Army Air Force that initially made the press release that the RAAF, in fact, had gotten their hands on a flying disc. Not debris, not, you know, not parts of a weather balloon or anything else. They specifically stated a disc. Did you want to say something,
well,
Roy?
Yeah, the Air Force, in fact, said they had, or the RAAF had recovered a flying saucer. Now, and I'd like to ask Mr. Class, yes, if you would apply, may I just say,
me, well, yeah, I think they called it a flying disc.
Said saucer disc was used in the story.
Okay.
And I wanted to ask you, would you apply your rationale that a tall tale can be spotted when a story changes significantly? To that story that the Air Force released that they had recovered a flying saucer and then the next day said it was a weather balloon. Could you apply your rationale to that story?
That is a good question that you asked, right? let's suppose that you're out walking tomorrow and you find some mysterious debris, for example, and you report to your local newspaper that you have found some mysterious debris. And supposing the next day that the Army announces, after examining it, that this is the debris from a test missile that went astray. now, the fact is that we talk about the Roswell Army Air Force or the Army Airfield announcing. Now, you and I both know that an airfield does not announce anything, that human beings announce things. And in fact, if one goes back...
Just for one second, it did say RAAF
announces.
Recovered a flying saucer.
Right. And fortunately, now... young Lieutenant Hout, Walter Hout, then a young lieutenant, had no training, no formal training or background as a press officer. He'd been trained as a navigator and a bombardier, and as he explained to me, you know, he was sort of drafted and told that you are now public information office. And when he wrote the release, he did not attribute it to anyone. He said the Roswell Army Airfield announces or has come into possession. I don't have it right in front of me here. And the reporter at the Roswell Daily Record, being a good reporter, said to him, you know, to whom shall we attribute this? Shall I attribute it to you, young Lieutenant Walter Hout? And Hout told him, no, attribute it to Major Jesse Marcel, the intelligence officer.
But Phil, wait a minute. We both know that Hout would not have taken that responsibility to write a press release about that unless he had been directed, which he also stated he was directed by Colonel Blanchard, who was the base commander.
This is what he now states. But if you go back to the original release as reported in the Roswell Daily Record, and I can dig it out later,
the point.
Will see that he attributed.
I have the press report in the book. But no, wait a minute.
Think a young lieutenant would insult his commanding officer?
I was in the United States Army. Now I know that you had never served in uniform. Dwight has never served in uniform, but I can tell you from my own firsthand experience that had that young lieutenant had made a gaffe as huge as that, he would have been out counting socks. in some supply room in the Antarctic, because if, in fact, it was not, as has been stated, that they, in fact, did get a flying disc and he had not been authorized by his colonel, he would have been hung out to dry.
Well, as a matter of fact, now let me comment on these things, Don. As a matter of fact, a couple weeks later, Hout was transferred to another job, he told me, because of this gaffe, and Marcel, a few months later, was transferred to a desk job in Washington, D.C.
And Marcel was also promoted to a lieutenant colonel.
And Marcel, 2 years later, in the middle of the Korean War, he resigned from the Air Force. And if you look
was
at
he
his,
promoted,
at,
Phil?
And you look at his
was
document.
Major Marcel promoted to a lieutenant colonel?
I would have to check the record.
Well, the answer is yes, and the answer is also... No, wait a minute. The answer is also that Marcel was the gentleman that wrote for President Harry Truman the press release that the Russians, in fact, had developed an atomic device.
That is his claim, and it's another false claim. He says...
Now, wait a minute. I just had Jesse Marcel Jr. on this program 2 weeks ago, and I asked him that specifically, and he said, yes, his father, in fact, did write that release, which President Truman read, to announce to...
All right, would you like to make a small $10 bet here, Don? As a matter of fact, if you'll check,
okay,
you'll find that President Truman did not make an announcement, did not read it on the radio, as Marcel wrongly recollected.
Well, let me take a break.
Actually, the White House put out a press release.
Let me take a break for a commercial because we're 2 minutes past it, and when we come back, we'll continue this, okay?
All right, fine.
Okay, we are going to continue with my guest tonight, joining us by telephone from Washington, D.C., Mr. Phil Klass, a senior editor with Aviation Week and Space Technology, and one of the best-known skeptical researchers of the UFO field around anywhere. And we are back with my guest, Phil Klass. All right, Phil, you were saying?
I just checked Marcel's records. You're correct. He was promoted to a lieutenant colonel on November 22nd, which would have been several months after this incident.
And so we should get back to tall tales can be spotted when they change, when the story changes significantly.
Yes. Well, the question that we were discussing was, who really authorized the issuance of this release? Now, if Blanchard authorized it, certainly when Hout was asked who authorized this, on whose say-so, he should have said Colonel Blanchard. But instead, and I'm reading from the original Roswell Daily Record, it says the intelligence office, this is the first sentence, the intelligence office of the 509th Bombardment Group at Roswell Army Air Field announced at noon today that the field has come into possession of a flying saucer. According to information released by the department, over the authority of Major J.A. Marcel, intelligence officer, the disc was recovered on a ranch in Roswell, and so on. So it was Hout now claims that he was told to put out the release on the authority of Blanchard. If so, he made a major goof. So what we have to do is to depend on this original article that it was Major Marcel. Now, I have heard...
Well, there's always another side to the coin that perhaps the reporter... Now, I'm just going using your logic. Perhaps the reporter made a gaffe. Perhaps the reporter made a mistake.
Oh, come on. Yeah, perhaps. Perhaps. But let's examine the
well,
heart
why,
of
why
it.
Would Hout say today that Blanchard was the person that authorized it? I'm curious what your reasoning is.
I missed your question, Don.
I'm curious as to why you would discount today what Walter Hout has stated about Colonel Blanchard being the individual that authorized him to make the press release. That's his story today. Why would he change it if in fact it was Major Marcel that authorized him? Because Blanchard was the base commander, would have been in Hout's chain of command. Marcel, who was the intelligence officer and not part of the press chain of command, would not have been generally the person that would have authorized Hout to make that press release.
So we're trying to determine 47 years later,
almost 48.
Who told Hout to put out the press release?
Right.
And according to the article, the first one published in the Roswell Daily Record, it was the intelligence office, not the base commander, not Blanchard, but Marcel. Now, I've heard it said, I've not been able to confirm this, as we both know, it was about, roughly 3 weeks earlier that the first flying saucer, flying disc report made national headlines by Kenneth Arnold on June 24th.
If we discount all the Foo Fighter reports from the end of the Second World War.
Yeah, and Ezekiel's flying wheel.
And the ghost rockets.
Let's
ghost rockets.
Get into Ezekiel.
Yeah. All right. So the first report that achieved international prominence was the one of June 24th. That was just several weeks earlier. And as a result, there were dozens of, maybe even hundreds, of UFO sighting reports that were making...
Now, as a result of what?
Pardon?
You just said, as a result, there were hundreds of reports. Now, I'm asking, as a result of what? Were there hundreds of reports, or were the hundreds of reports the result of Kenneth Arnold's sighting? I want to know, being very clear as to what you're saying.
They were, in my opinion, the result of the national...
hysteria.
Attention and widespread publicity.
I just wanted to be very clear that that's what you were saying.
Yes, yes. And so I...
Because another rational person could take another position.
Yes.
Yeah, yes.
I've heard it said, I've not been able to confirm it, that a prize, because of, what are these? What are these flying discs? That a prize of $3,000 had been offered to anyone that recovered it, one of these flying discs. I've not been able to confirm that, but I've seen references to it. It is conceivable that Major Marcel had heard of that, and that he hoped to be the one that collected the $3,000.
Mr. Class, that is worthy of you.
No, wait a minute. Phil, now the man was the intelligence officer of the 509th.
And as we both know,
his military
intelligence officers are never wrong.
Oh, well,
absolutely
never.
Not. Nor is Phil Class.
Pardon?
Nor is Phil Class.
Phil, that's not worthy. That's not a worthy remark. I don't for one second would even conceive of that. This man was a combat veteran of the Second World War.
Not a combat veteran, a combat veteran.
Boy, Phil, you're playing with fire because I've got the kill button here. I've got the kill button. This man was a combat veteran of the Second World War.
Didn't you tell me to be nice to this man tonight?
I did. I did. I mean, Phil. You know, Phil's back there. He's up late. He's moving along now. And we, Phil, the man would not have risked his military career. Nor can I believe that he would have mistook this debris as something other than prosaic. If in fact it was not prosaic,
He had never seen. So far as I've been able to determine, he had never seen a radar corner reflector, a radar target.
But he sure had seen weather balloons, and these balloons were no different than any other balloons.
Oh, they were. They were very much different. And you see...
How were they different?
How were they different? Normally, a weather balloon... Let's go back.
Can I just say one thing? You're butting the New York Times here, because the New York Times says that they weren't different. In fact, the New York Times says that the photograph that appeared the next day on the Roswell paper was the mogul balloon. So just so you know that.
All right, well, we're going to have to come back and talk about what do we mean by a mogul balloon.
No, just the balloon. They're saying that what was what crushed. That was the crash material. So when you say that that Marcel didn't know what this looked like, that we all know what it looked like. That was nothing extraordinary. It was
gentlemen, I'll give you a choice. You either give me 2 minutes of uninterrupted speaking time, or I'm going to bed. Now, you have your choice.
Sure, you can have it in about 4 minutes, Phil, because in about a minute, we've got to go to the half-hour break.
Well, as I say, you either give me, as a guest, the opportunity to respond without interruption, or else I'm going to bed. It's past midnight, and I give you your choice.
Well, I just said sure as soon as we come back from the break.
All right.
My, Phil, you're getting testy.
No, it's just that you're paying me $50,000 for this appearance.
Well, it's from the CIA.
But I don't need the money.
It's from the CIA, Phil. They've got all kinds of money.
To be very serious, when you make statements, it is traditional to allow the guest then to respond. And what I was going to tell you was that radar was developed during World War II, highly secret at that time, and the average GI did not see a radar target balloon.
Okay, now, Phil, we're going to have to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue with this. My name is Don Ecker. The show is UFOs Tonight. You've been listening to myself, Dwight Schultz, and our special guest joining us from Washington, D.C., Mr. Philip Klass. And by the sounds of it, I'd say Phil's upset. But when we come back, he's going to have his 2 minutes to finish on this idea of radar, and you're not going to want to miss this.
We'll be taking calls shortly. I said we'll be taking calls shortly now that I'm on mic. And if you're within the 818-213 or 310 area codes, it's a nominal. Once again, we'll be taking calls shortly, so get out your pen and paper and take down these numbers. If you're within the 818-213 or 310 area codes.
Phil, I tell you, we're going to go back now with our guest, Phil. And Phil, you were talking about radar.
Yes. The weather balloons that were being launched from Roswell Army Air Field did not use radar targets. They were balloons that carried little instruments that measured the barometric pressure and would radio back, but they were not tracked by radar because in those early post-war years, there were not many radars available for tracking balloon-borne targets. They would come along through the years. So Marcel probably, almost certainly, had never seen a radar corner reflector, and especially the unusual type that was being used for the Project Mogul balloon experiments. So it is not at all surprising that he would find the debris unusual. Now, let's read the description given the next day by Rancher Mac Brazel, the man who found it, and let's listen to his description. He says the article, which appeared in the July 9th issue of the Roswell Daily Record, he said, Brazel said that he did not see it, the object, fall from the sky, and did not see it before it was torn up, so he did not know the size or shape it might have been. But he thought it might have been about as large as a tabletop. The balloon which held it up, now the it is the corner radar reflector or the radar target, the balloon which held it up, if that was how it worked, must have been about 12 feet long, he felt, measuring the distance by the use of the room in which he sat. The rubber was a smoky gray in color and scattered over an area about 200 yards in diameter. When the debris was gathered up, the tinfoil, paper, tape, and sticks made a bundle about 3 feet long and 7 or 8 inches thick, while the rubber made a bundle about 18 or 20 inches long and about 8 inches thick. In all, he estimated, the entire lot would have weighed maybe 5 pounds.
Okay, now.
The description by the man who found the debris.
Right. If, in fact, this material was, to begin with, let's just start looking at what Brazel is credited to have said. Because he's been dead for about 35 years now, roughly.
Right. He died in the 60s, as I recall.
About 1960 or 61, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
If this material...
This is what he said on the night of Tuesday night, July 8th, 1947.
If this material was spread out over 200 yards...
Yes.
What would have caused these balloons to spread out over that distance? Because what we're talking about...
Let's talk balloon and radar reflector.
Well, what was the radar reflector but balsa wood and aluminum foil? There's nothing remarkable about either balsa wood or aluminum foil.
You need the aluminum foil to reflect the radar energy.
Right.
But aluminum foil has no structural strength. So what you do is to make a radar reflector in those days, you take thin tinfoil and you glue it or attach it to some parchment paper, something that has structural strength that you need to support the structure of the radar target. And furthermore, as Professor Charles Moore has said, in terms of the Project Mogul balloon, to strengthen it, the manufacturer added sort of like a scotch tape with colored figures of flowers and so on that he happened to have in his shop. So this is the radar reflector consists of parchment to which is attached tinfoil.
But my point, Bill, is that there's not a thing about this that's remarkable.
It's not remarkable if you have seen it, but if you've never seen one before, and if you've never seen the debris from a crashed one before, is unusual.
Excuse me, just for a second. Take Brazel's description, the one that you've just given me, that came from the man, all right, himself.
Yes.
Scotch tape. Is there anything he was able to recognize the scotch tape, right? He said that. So he recognized that. Then he recognized the rubber. Everything that you say, he said, is recognizable, and he obviously recognized it. So there was nothing extraordinary. He clearly was able to describe ordinary things.
But Brazel had never seen anything like this before.
Well, he had because he knew how to say scotch tape. He knew how to say rubber. You had to say those things. They're not in your lexicon if you haven't seen it before. You say, I don't know what that stuff was. He said rubber, he said scotch tape, he described it very accurately and eloquently.
Let me ask you this, Dwight. Supposing...
I'm a little unclear. Did Brazel... I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but did Brazel's description appear before or after the Air Force retraction?
Before or after what?
The Air Force retraction of the story.
It appeared... the next day after General Ramey in the early evening of Tuesday, July 8th, after the debris had been flown there and been examined by a man by the name of Newton, who was his meteorologist, who said, you know, it's a weather balloon and a radar target. And so Ramey announced it. The early evening, or I guess about 6 in the evening on Tuesday, and almost as Ramey was announcing it in Fort Worth, or shortly afterwards, Brazel was being interviewed in the office of the Roswell Daily Record, both by their reporters and by a reporter named Callahan, from the Associated Press office in Albuquerque, who had driven down following the announcement of the flying saucer being recovered.
Well, let's jump ahead to approximately 1979, 1980, when Jesse Marcel was interviewed on the television program In Search Of, which was narrated by Leonard Nimoy. When he was interviewed and speaking about the Roswell incident, no, actually, I guess, Phil, it would have been later than that, because Moore's book came out in 1980, so probably would have been, 81, 82.
Well, let's go back to some of his earlier interviews that he gave in 1978 to a New Orleans TV station discovered him on or about the time that Stanton Friedman discovered him.
Well, he was buddies with that television station, the program
manager.
It was
a radio station, but in any
they
way,
were ham radio
ahead.
Operator buddies.
Go ahead.
Well, what I was saying, though, let's discuss that in a second, but when he went on the television program In Search Of, he was very articulate that what he found he could neither identify, and according to his testimony, they tried to burn this material, they tried to cut the material, they tried to dent the material with a sledgehammer. And he was very succinct in stating that the material could not be damaged, cut, or burned. They tried. This is what he said. Now, my question is, if in fact this material was not some type of exotic material, but was in fact this prosaic black rubber, balsa wood, aluminum foil, scotch tape, how could he not have harmed the material, and why would he have said that?
All right. And those are good questions. Don, did you ever serve as an intelligence officer?
I was involved in special operations, Phil.
Right,
I had security clearance.
Let's try to imagine that you were Jesse Marcel, and let's turn back the clock, and you find this unfamiliar debris on the Brazel Ranch, and you bring it back. Now, this is 1947. Now, you know the Cold War is getting hotter. As an intelligence officer, you know that the Russians have captured a number of very clever German engineers, taken them back to the Soviet Union to try to exploit their expertise. So your first thought as an intelligence officer in July of 47 should be, that, my gosh, maybe this is a Soviet spy vehicle that crashed here. All right, now as an Army Air Force intelligence officer, you know that the largest center of technical expertise within the Army Air Force is at Wright Field. They have all kinds of metallurgists. They have all kinds of electronics experts there. Now you have in your hands what could be some very advanced material that the Russians have somehow, maybe through the Germans, discovered, and they're using to make spy vehicles. My gosh, would you try to burn this? Would you try to hit it with a sledgehammer? Heavens no, you would protect it as if it were life itself. You'd take it back, you would call Colonel Blanchard, say, Colonel Blanchard, notify Wright Field, we found this unusual material, we're taking excellent care of it, we're going to fly it to Wright Field and let them run tests in their laboratory.
But according to what Marcel said, debris field was several hundred yards wide, and he estimated that this debris field was approximately 3/4 mile long, and there was a lot of this stuff. Now, I can understand.
Now, that's what he recalled 30 years later, but we have Brazel's statement, which indicates, but again, as a matter of fact, if you will go back to the interview that Brazel gave back in 1978 or 79 to the New Orleans station, and I have a partial transcript.
You mean Marcel?
Marcel, right. Yes. You will find that Brazel, 30-odd years later, said that he gave the stuff to the boys in the back room, that he had more important work, paperwork, to do. So he did not actually watch them allegedly hitting it with a sledgehammer or trying to burn it. He had more pressing paperwork.
Okay, Phil, let's
go
right,
well,
that
tells you something about how urgent or important he thought it was at that time.
I've got to take another quick break. When we come back, we'll continue this very fascinating conversation. My special guest tonight, Mr. Phil Klass, senior editor at Aviation Week Space Technology, and someone that has been chasing the UFO riddle for well over 30 years. My name is Don Ecker. The show is UFOs Tonight. You're listening to the Cable Radio Network, and stand by because we have lots more. And that, if I'm not mistaken, is a theme from The Outer Limits. Now, let me tell you about gray matter. You know, back with my very special guest this evening, Mr. Phil Klass. Phil, the last time Renee gave out the telephone numbers, the board lit right up across the board. Now, we're not going to take any calls for a couple of minutes yet because I want to continue this, but we're going to start taking some calls then shortly. Now, the thing that Marcel did state, however, when he was talking before the cameras of In Search Of, is that he did try to cut some of this material. He did try to burn some of this material with a Zippo lighter, and this material, according to his testimony, could not be marked. What do you think, if in fact it was the material that you're describing, balsa wood, aluminum foil, how could this be? Or do you believe that Marcel is telling a lie? And if so, why would he?
Well, first off, if one goes back to his earlier statements given in 78 and 79, he corrected himself. At one point he said, I don't have the transcript in front of me, that you could not bend it. And then he corrected himself to say, you could not crease it, that it would unbend. That's exactly what you would expect if it was tin foil attached to rigid parchment. But we must not, I'm getting along in years, I'm even older than Jesse Marcel was when he was trying to recall these things, and you're a very young man, Don, but sometime when you get older, you'll discover that when you try to recall things that happened 30 or 40 years ago, that some errors creep into it. But let's talk about...
I can recall 30 years ago. I'm going to be 45 my next birthday, and 30 years ago, I was 15, and I can very well recall a lot of things.
I'm more human, and I'm 47, and I do have trouble recalling things.
But if Marcel did these things, tried to burn it, tried to hit it with a sledgehammer, that he later recalled, then he was a terribly stupid person. Now, as a matter of fact, Marcel should have known, because everybody in Roswell knew, if they read the newspaper, that the Army Missile Center at White Sands, about 150 miles south of Roswell, was testing experimental, rebuilt German V-2 missiles, and occasionally they would go astray. One impacted not too far from Roswell. Another one fell into Mexico, and so on.
But not now, during this time frame.
Pardon?
Not during this time frame.
If you'll come or if you'll go and look at the Roswell Daily Record, you'll find that several weeks before the Roswell incident, one of these V-2s went astray and impacted... Oh, I think about 50 miles from Roswell. It was going on at the same time. And if Marcel read the local newspaper, as I did on microfilm, he would have known that. And so when he found this debris, if it struck him as being unusual, unique, the first thing he should have done before he told Hout to put out a press release, the first thing he should have done was to call White Sands and say, hey guys, I know you're firing V-2 missiles. I know they sometimes go astray. I found this unusual debris. Could it be from one of these formerly secret German V-2 missiles that you're testing.
Yes, but still,
he didn't do that.
The material.
He did not, and this also tells us that he was not a very smart intelligence officer.
Why did they promote him?
Why did they promote him? Probably because he had had a reasonably good record.
Well, yes.
Why did he resign 2 years later, claiming that living in Washington, D.C. was an undue hardship?
Well, everybody knows that's true, so he was not a liar anyway, right?
Phil, the one thing about this case, and you've got to admit that there are some very, very strange aspects to this case. For years, Randall and Schmidt had tried to find out from Sheridan Cabot what, in fact, Cabot witnessed there. Cabot steadfastly maintained that he was not present during the time of this incident. He told them that time and time again. Sheridan Cabot, of course, was
have
the CIC
No,
wait
have
a minute.
You heard the tape
I
recording?
Gave you 2 minutes. I
have
gave
you heard the tape recordings?
No.
I haven't either. Why won't Randall and Schmidt release those?
Well, Randall is going to send me a copy of these interviews.
Good.
Randall is going
good.
To do that. But let me finish. Cabot told him time and time again that he was not present. Yet, with the Air Force report that was released on September the 8th, Cabot came out and said, yes, I was there. I went out with Marcel. I saw the material. I knew right away what it was, is what Cabot said. I knew right away. Well, if in fact he did know right away, he didn't tell his friend Jesse Marcel what it was, or he didn't tell Colonel Blanchard, because if he would have, this whole brouhaha would never have happened. How do you explain that? It's unexplainable.
Well, again, 40 years takes its toll of your recollections.
It's true.
I am waiting to hear those tapes. Kevin Randall made that statement, or Dick Don Schmidt, I forget which, that, you know, this is contrary, we have it on tape. I said, send me a copy of the tape. I've never heard from them.
Well, let's stick to things that we can, you know, we can look at in real time. Now, William Broad, in his article in the New York Times front page, indicates and says that photograph was a Mogul balloon. That photograph that appeared in the Roswell paper in the retraction was the Mogul balloon. Now, you can tell us today, because you must know what that, you know very well what that looked like. Was the debris that was there in the office that they were holding the Mogul balloon?
Well, there were several or many Mogul balloons.
Well, was it similar to a Mogul balloon? What they were holding, was it similar to a Mogul balloon?
All right, now give me 1 minute without interruption. The debris that was found on the Brazos Ranch is believed to be that from a test balloon that was launched on June 4th to test the radar tracking. Could the radar successfully track it? And it was not one of the giant Mogul balloons that would later be used to carry the very heavy instruments. It was part of the Mogul program. But it is my understanding, and I confess that I've been much too busy with my condominium and my Aviation Week work to read all 700 pages of the Air Force documents, that these were more conventional, it was a cluster of more conventional weather balloons, a cluster carrying this unusual shaped radar target, or corner reflector, or maybe carrying several of them, and possibly even an acoustic sensor. But it is my understanding that the Air Force, I'm not an Air Force spokesman, it is my understanding that the Air Force and Professor Charles Moore believe that the debris on the Brazos Ranch came from the June 4th launch, which was not a giant Mogul-type balloon. And incidentally, Randall and Schmidt agree that the photograph taken in Ramey's office does indeed show the debris from a balloon-borne radar target.
Yes.
Now,
you've had your minute. Now, come on.
Yeah.
Come on. General, the problem with this is that DeBose General DeBose says categorically on tape that the material in the office was the cover, that the real material that had been collected was whisked away. And
that's
that
not what he told Jamie Sandoval.
That is on tape, and I have heard that. That is
you
on
heard
tape.
The Jamie Sandoval?
No, I've heard DeBose on tape say that no one ever saw
it. Right, well, then you contact you, Don Ecker, you know Jamie Sandoval, because Sandoval published an article in the MUFON Journal, a direct verbatim interview with DeBose.
Do you trust that journal?
And DeBose, I'm going on my memory here, said the material. First off, he said Randolph Schmidt never showed me those photographs in Ramey's office. If they had, I would have said, yes, that's the material. But let's suppose.
The interview that Schmidt conducted with him, Phil, on videotape, and he says expressly, no doubt about it,
all right, well,
the material
you get,
was changed.
All right, then you get the audio tape of the interview that Jamie Sandoval had with DeBose, and of course DeBose was 92 years old at the time. But let's assume.
Right, what's that have to do with it?
You can't trust anybody over 70 is what you're saying to us.
Well, what I'm saying to you is that if you will listen to the tape, the Jamie Sandoval tape, you will get quite a different impression. But let's assume that you are correct, and that the debris photographed in Ramey's office was not the debris recovered on the Brazos Ranch. Let's assume that Ramey said, oh boy, we've got to keep this secret. We've got to find some substitute debris. Where in the world would Ramey, on short notice, be able to get his hands on a radar target and balloon-like material, which had been lying in the sun for several weeks and was thus deteriorated? Well, I suppose he could call his meteorology office. He could call Newton. And you recall that Newton, the meteorologist, does say he was called to come over to Ramey's office. But Newton, who is still alive today, has never said that General Ramey said, hey, find me an old balloon and an old radar reflector and beat it up into small pieces and bring that over to my office. So you tell me, where did Ramey find that debris?
Well, why would, if in fact it was only this debris, why would General Exxon then have stated that this debris or a part of this debris recovered was sent to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, if in fact everybody knew it was a simple weather or mogul balloon? And let's face it, the Project Mogul balloons, that stuff didn't stay secret forever.
It was declassified in 1970, as I recall it.
This material, well, people knew about it and were talking about it in the 50s.
Not as to, they knew there was a cover story that these were scientific balloons. The actual purpose of it, the intent of it, that was still classified. But where would General Ramey get the debris?
Phil, I'm going to have to interrupt you. We're at the top of the hour. We'll cover that when we come back, okay?
Okay,
stand by. All right, my name is Don Ecker. Joining me in studio tonight is Mr. Dwight Schultz. The name of the program, UFOs Tonight. You're listening to the Cable Radio Network. Each week, we bring you some of the most fascinating information in this fascinating topic of UFOs. Tonight's guest, special guest, Mr. Philip Klass, author of numerous books, editor of the Skeptical UFO Newsletter. We're going to tell you more about that in a while and how you can get it, and a senior editor with Aviation Week and Space Technology. We'll be back after this.